Good evening. I would ask if you'd go ahead and open your Bibles, Ecclesiastes chapter 9, Wisdom and Folly. Here in Ecclesiastes chapter 9, if you have an outline, go ahead and open it to your PM side, and if you don't, there's still some back there in the back. As you might imagine, Solomon talks a lot about wisdom. He has a lot to say concerning wisdom, and in this situation, he's going to utilize a number of animals to make his points. And it's interesting as well, I find it interesting anyway, that a lot of these phrases that he's going to use employing these animals, it seems almost like we have phrases that stem from them. In chapter 9, notice in verse 13, he opens here, he says, "The wisdom I have also seen under the sun, and it seemed great to me. There was a little city with few men in it, and a great king came against it, besieged it, and built great snares around it. Now there was found in it a poor man, a poor wise man, and he by his wisdom delivered the city, yet no one remembered that same poor man. Then I said, wisdom is better than strength. Nevertheless, the poor man's wisdom is despised, and his words are not heard. Words of the wise spoken quietly should be heard, rather than the shout of a ruler of fools. Wisdom is better than weapons of war, but one sinner destroys much good." In verse 1 of chapter 10, he says, "Dead flies putrefy the perfumer's ointment and cause it to give off a foul odor. So does a little folly to one respected for wisdom and honor. A wise man's heart is at his right hand, but a fool's heart is at his left." He says, don't be the fly which ruins the ointment. It doesn't take a lot of flies to ruin a perfectly good ointment, and a valuable one at that. You could spend a lot of money in the spices and the oils in order to make an ointment, and it could be ruined by a single fly, especially if you imagine it while you're trying to sell it. If people see flies floating and stuff, they generally don't buy. In this case, what you have kind of is a continuation of verses 13 through 18 of chapter 9 and him drawing it to a conclusion in this fly analogy. He says that it's always better to be wise there at the end of chapter 9. It doesn't always work out, but it's always better to be wise. Even more important than be rich, as he has talked about already. Being wise is always more important. And in fact, in the setting he gives here, even a poor wise man is able to, with some small semblance of control over the world around him, able to stop this invasion that's taking place. And he doesn't draw on what exactly happens. They would have been much more affiliated with the siege engines that would have existed at the time and the kind of technique or what was going on in a situation. He doesn't deal with that kind of thing. Because everybody knows, in his setting, everybody recognizes it only takes one wise person to make the right decision and the right move to sometimes win a war, to sometimes win the day in battle. But just the same, the foolishness of one can ruin the wisdom of many. If you leave the door open when it's supposed to be closed and locked, and something awful happens, it doesn't matter how vigilant everyone else was. If it's on your watch and you are a fool that the army tries to take the city, they have a much better chance of succeeding on your watch. Because you're a fool, it only takes one fool. Which is why these kinds of roles, these guards on the city wall, which is why taking care of these kinds of situations was so important, and why you didn't leave them to fools, why you made sure your best men took those positions. We need to be those men for God. We need to be those people, those guards, vigilant always. As Christians, we need to make sure that we are not the fly in the ointment of this world. In fact, the opposite should be true. That oftentimes Christians and the light that we show and the lives that we live are what keeps God from destroying the earth, but also what brings judgment upon the people around us. That if we can do it, if we can perform these Christian concepts and we can live a Christian life, not perfectly, but we can accept the will of God, we effectively prove that it's possible, that it can be done. And Paul argues that very thing about himself in 1 Timothy chapter 1, in verse 17, 15 through 17, where he talks about how awful of a person he was. And it's almost as if he's arguing for all of those people he will ever talk to, and they will say, "But I'm just a terrible person." And Paul goes, "Do you want to compare lists? And if God was capable of saving me, then he's capable of saving anyone. But our example sets the standard for those around us. And we can be the fly in the ointment for that person next door or down the street when we don't control our influence on people, when we don't control our example." And then what he concludes here in chapter 10 with the fly in this concept, nothing is foolproof for a talented fool. You can't build a machine that a fool can't destroy. And usually much easier than you built it. You can't secure a city in such a way that a fool could not find a way of allowing invaders into it. We need to be individuals who are wise at heart. Keep that wisdom, he says, at our right hand. But a fool's heart is on his left. A wise man keeps his heart within his reach. He keeps control of it. Because your heart, in the biblical sense, the attitude, right, the commitments that you make, what propels you in this world is important, and it will set the standard for your future. But if you do not control your heart, if it's on your left hand, he says, things are going to go well. He says, verse 3, even when a fool walks along the way, he lacks wisdom, and he shows everyone that he is a fool. This will play somewhat into point number 3, but it's better to be silent and be thought a fool than to open your mouth and remove all doubt. We need to be individuals who keep the fly out of the ointment, who maintain our control over our example. Now, our reputation might take a hit from time to time because we're doing the right thing, because we have no choice but to do what is right and good. And the apostles were not always seen as good and righteous individuals. In fact, Paul, his life was attempted at a number of times. They tried to kill the man. That's not a good reputation, and yet he was a righteous man, one who was justified, because his example, while not always helpful to the people around him, more precisely, not always pleasant to the people around him, it was in fact godly. In chapter 10, he goes on in verse 4, he says, "If the spirit of the ruler rises against you, do not leave your post, for conciliation pacifies great offenses." Conciliation. Doing what you're supposed to be doing. He says, don't leave your post. In verse 5, "There is an evil I have seen under the sun, as an error proceeding from the ruler. Folly is set in great dignity, while the rich sit in a lowly place. I have seen servants on horses while princes walk on the ground like servants. He who digs a pit will fall into it, and whoever breaks through a wall will be bitten by a serpent. He who quarries stones may be hurt by them, and he who splits wood may be endangered by it." He says, there are a lot of things in this world that are just backwards. When you set folly in a place of dignity, when you lift up foolishness, and I have to say, brethren, this world is really about that right now. When we take things that in times past have been sacred, that have been understood to be the way things should be done, and they are godly and they are righteous because they are explained to us in the scriptures, and we twist those things and we laud those things and we lift them up into places they ought not be, and we call it pride. When people are proud of the sin and the iniquity that they are involved in, kingdoms fail and kingdoms are brought low. That is what has happened in countless nations, in countless kingdoms in the past, in specific cities like Sodom and Gomorrah. When sin is raised up, the people are destroyed because of it. And he says that folly at times is put in a position of great dignity. And what he's comparing this to. That's his point, ultimately, there at the beginning of verse 6. These are all comparisons to it, and the other comparison sounds so ridiculous to us. Right? The rich sit in a lowly place. What have you ever seen that? Not that it can't happen. We're talking in generalities again here in Proverbs and Ecclesiastes. We're talking in generalities. That's not what happens. The rich don't take a lowly place. That's why it seems so absurd. Is that how it should be? Sure. Everyone should fight over the lowest of places. Not fight literally, obviously, but that's not how life works, and that's not how the world works. Do you go around seeing servants on horses while princes walk the ground like servants? No, servants walk while the prince rides. If at best, the prince rides and the servant rides. But the prince doesn't walk the horse that he places the servant on. That's not how the world works. When you dig a pit, you don't expect to fall in it. You expect it to remain for whatever you intended on falling in it, but I'm fairly certain that no one digs a pit and goes, hey, I wonder if I could fall in that, and then goes ahead and does it. Whoever breaks through a wall will be bitten by a serpent. He who quarries stones may be hurt by them, and he who splits wood may be endangered by it. And we recognize that risk. When you quarry stones, you don't drag the one off the bottom. If you quarry stones in a foolish way, imagine you had this huge heap of stones and you grab that bottom one, what's going to happen to all the ones above it? They're going to fall on you. And it doesn't take much common sense for you to look at this pile and go, I probably shouldn't take this bottom one. And yet a fool would not know that. And yet that is the way the world is acting when it exemplify sin, when it lifts sin up in a place of dignity, when it puts foolishness and folly in a place that does not belong. It is as if that individual pulled that bottom stone and then wonders why all the stones are falling on top of them. Why they got bit by a snake when they shoved their hand in a hole. Why they fell into the pit they just dug because they weren't paying attention. He says there in verse 10, if the axe is dull, one does not sharpen the edge, then he must use more strength, but wisdom brings success. I wonder if verse 10, he's not talking about a person. When the axe is dull, you know people that aren't very sharp, and they have to work harder to get the same amount of work done. My father taught me a long time ago, and I don't always listen to him, to work smarter, not harder. If you have two men and they've got the same equal stacks of wood, and one man, as his axe dulls, he takes the time to sharpen it, do you suppose he will cut more than the man who doesn't sharpen his axe? Yeah. It seems counterintuitive, and that man who doesn't sharpen his axe is wailing on this log thinking that he's going to work faster than the other man because that man's taking a break. That man's just sharpening his axe. But the wise man knows that sharpening your tools, keeping them in good working order, is the successful way. And what's going to lead you to success? So when you're trying to drive a screw, you don't use a butter knife. Unless it's like some rare, weird emergency where you have to get that screw in. When are you ever in that situation? Go get a screwdriver. The likelihood of you stripping that screw and ruining whatever it was is a lot lower. And yet, do we always listen to wisdom? No, because who here hasn't gotten a butter knife to get that screw in just because you needed it in that moment? You didn't need it that much. Sharpen your tools, or it will come back to bite you. All of these things he's talking about come back to bite you, but there, I have to get back to it. Verse 6, folly is set in great dignity, and we pass right over it. And we can make a big deal about these others because they seem interesting, because they apply to our life, and because they're obvious. But he says, folly set in great dignity is just as bad. It's just as ridiculous. It's just as absurd. And yet this world is feeding it to us every day. This world is telling us again and again that sin is acceptable. Not even acceptable anymore. Now it's moved beyond acceptable to praised. And what are we going to do about it? Are we going to sharpen our axe? Or are we just going to beat our head against this beat our head against this log hoping that it splits. Well, let's sharpen our axe. Let's use our wisdom to teach and to instruct, to understand God's word so that we can perform it and share it with those around us. Let's not be the dull axes. In verse 11, he goes on to another, though it's the same creature. He's going to move on beyond it. He says, a serpent may bite when it is not charmed. The babbler is no different. Let me read that again. A serpent may bite when it is not charmed. The babbler is no different. And here, he's going to lead with the point. Grabbing a snake before it's charmed, for that matter, when it's charmed, is a terrible idea. But at least when it's charmed, at least if it's done well by a person who is good at something like that, and don't ask me how that's done, I have no idea. I just leave snakes well enough alone. But if you're able to charm it and you try to grab it before it's charmed, the dumb thing's going to bite you. And I call it dumb, but really, you're being dumb. And he says the babbler is no different. The one who talks and doesn't control his mouth, his tongue, those things are going to come back to bite you. And his whole point here is about controlling your tongue. He says in verse 12, the words of the wise man's mouth are gracious, but the lips of a fool shall swallow him up. The words of his mouth begin with foolishness, and the end of his task, the end of his talk, is raving madness. A fool also multiplies words. No man knows what is to be, who can tell him what will be after him. The labor of fools wearies them, for they do not even know how to go to the city. You think about the words of fools. When was the last time you heard a fool except that they didn't know what they were talking about? Or who weren't absolutely sure they were right? Now, we can be like that too, can't we? We can act like we know what we're talking about and that we're right even when we're not. But we shouldn't be fools like that. But the people who know, they sound like raving madmen. And individuals like this weary those around them, usually their eyes as they roll regularly around in their head. They don't even know how to go to the city. That is the basic function of a person out in the field. You got to get back home. And they can't even figure that out. Woe to you, O land, when your king is a child and your princes feast in the morning. Now, that's not to say that you're in a bad situation if your prince is young. That's not what he's talking about. He's talking about your prince acting like a child. That he is advanced in age. Because it's one thing if a prince acts like a child when they're a child, just like any child. But when an adult acts like a child, and when that adult happens to be the prince, then you really have problems. Because what's that prince going to grow up to be? Theoretically, he's going to grow up to be king. And even as a prince, that individual, that fool, is dangerous. But if he becomes king, he is more so. Blessed are you, O land, when your king is the son of nobles. Now, he's not talking again about lineage. He's talking about the noble individual. He's talking about an individual who has been raised well. And your prince feasts at the proper time, not in the morning. There are things to do in the morning. That's not the proper time. For strength and not for drunkenness. Because of laziness, the building decays, and through idleness of hands, the house leaks. A feast is made for laughter, and wine makes merry, but money answers everything, he says. That's the way people try to solve all their problems. If I can't solve it with merriment and feasting and drunkenness, I'll throw money at it. But what does a house that's leaking need? Repaired. The time invested. And if you don't solve the problem when a problem arises, if you let such a thing keep going and causing more problems, your problem that was small is going to become a problem that is large. And it's going to continue to get worse and worse and worse. And then in verse 20, because remember, he's talking about your language, what you talk about. Now think about that in relation to verses 16 through 19. If you don't learn to control your tongue when you're young, you're going to have a harder time controlling it when you're old. And if you don't learn how to control your tongue, the things that you say are going to come back to bite you. And the hole that you try to patch with your words, ill-spoken, are going to make the hole bigger. Sometimes you got to learn to quit shoveling. Put the shovel down. In verse 20, he says, "Do not curse the king even in your thought. Do not curse the rich even in your bedroom. Even in those places you think you are safe and private and secure. For a bird of the air may carry your voice, and a bird in flight may tell the matter." And we say things like, "Well, you weren't supposed to hear that." Well, you really shouldn't have said that. There are all kinds of times when we think we are alone and we say things that we ought not. Now, if it's something that ought not be said, then we ought not say it, period. But there are even things that we communicate because we think it's private, because we think we have this odd end of the building and there's no way anyone else can hear. What should not be heard by little ears should not come out of big mouths. In James chapter 1 and verse 19, James tells Christians that he's writing to, he says, "So then, my beloved brethren, let every man be swift to hear, slow to speak, slow to wrath, for the wrath of man does not produce the righteousness of God." We get those backwards. Too often we are swift to speak and slow to hear. He would go on in James chapter 3 to talk about the taming of the tongue and how difficult it is and how complicated it is and how hard such a matter can be. And yet it is something that we are responsible for doing, at least trying. And I'll tell you, sometimes we don't even try. We say things like, "Well, I'm just saying the truth," sometimes. But just because something is true doesn't mean it needs to be said. Matthew chapter 15, verses 11 and then 18 through 21, we learn from Jesus that the mouth is an outlet of the heart. So the things, remember, he's talking even about the thoughts of your head. Not just the curses that come out of your mouth, which ought not come out of your mouth. How about we working on restricting those thoughts even coming out? How about we work on, because that's what I've been working on for quite a while. I have relatively learned how to control my actions and not do a lot of the things I would normally think about doing and saying a lot of the things that I would normally think about saying. And you might go, "Well, that's great, Chris." Not really, because I'd really rather not even think them. I'd really, those ideas and those thoughts never come to mind. I am not the man I used to be. And I'm thankful that that's the case. I don't involve myself in the things that I used to involve myself in retaliation, in getting back at people, in returning ill for ill and unkind word for unkind word. And there weren't a lot of people who could match me in my school, but that didn't solve any of my problems. That didn't help anything. If anything, my quick wit made things worse, though I was hopeful they would make them better. They never did. Only worse. And so I come from a background of individuals who have a quick wit. I learned from my family to be quick with the retort, with the comeback, and to strike first. And that is not Christ's way. It is not Christ's way to return evil for evil or unkind word for unkind word. But it is no less an issue that I think those thoughts to begin with. It's no less a thing that impurity comes into my mind that I would think such an unkind thing. Because in Matthew chapter 15 and verse 11, he says, not what goes into the mouth defiles a man, but what comes out of the mouth, this defiles a man. The Israelites had it backwards. Especially the rabbis and the scholars and the Pharisees, they cleanse the outside of the cup because what you see is the outside of the cup. And as long as the outside of the cup looks good, then you think the contents are good. And yet if the inside of the cup is not clean, which is the more important thing, then the contents are disease, are awful, or terrible. And these individuals, they were upset at Jesus because his disciples were not washing their hands like they were supposed to, like the tradition taught. Now, I'm not against hand washing. We encourage our kids before we eat meals to wash their hands. It's good practice, but not for spiritual reasons. There's nothing intrinsically spiritual about washing your hands. And yet they had made it of such. They had made it such a thing, and Jesus says that it's not what goes into the mouth that defiles a man, but what comes out of him. That defiles him. In verse 18 he says, but those things which proceed out of the mouth come from the heart. Why does the what comes out of your mouth defile you? Because it comes out of your heart. Because that which it comes out is from within. And they defile a man, he says. For out of the heart proceed evil thoughts, murders, adulteries, fornications, theft, false witness, blasphemies. These are the things which defile a man. But to eat with unwashed hands, he says, does not defile a man. So the writer here, Solomon of Ecclesiastes, is saying, not only should you not say these things because a little bird might carry it. We have phrases like, you know, a little bird told me. I wonder if it's not from this. I don't know where it's from, so I can't say for certain. But there's a lot of those. The fly in the ointment. The little bird telling you things. But he says it's not even enough not to curse the king. And not to say these things, because it might go back to the king and you might get in real trouble. But he says, more than that, control the thoughts. Control the intents of our hearts. Because as we understand Hebrews chapter 4, 12 and 13, God sees into those inward places. Those are things we cannot hide from God. He knows what our heart is saying, whether our mouth says it or not. And we might want to control that first. We might want to work on our mouths first so that those things aren't said to begin with. But then we've got to move on to our hearts. We've got to move on to dedicating those hearts to God so that what comes out of our mouth is purity, is truth, is righteousness. So that we, not always wise, but working to become more wise, do not rush in headlong into a serpent. Do not get into a situation we are unprepared for. That we do not become the fly which ruins that ointment. And that little birds, and it doesn't take little birds for God to know what we're thinking, but so that those thoughts are not carried to God and He be aware of them simply because they don't exist anymore. We need to be individuals who work on who we are, both outwardly in our actions and in our speech, and inwardly in our thoughts and our intents of the heart, that we can be the man of God, that we can be the child of God. And if you desire that today, to become the child of God that God is calling you to be, the greatest wisdom that you can exemplify in this life now is to become that child, is to inherit eternal life through His Son, to be washed and redeemed according to His will, and to obey that. To obey that will so that you are not that fool who pulls the stone out of the bottom of the pile and dies in the process. Because that's what we're doing. We're taking a risk when we are not saved in His Son, when we are not the child of God we need to be. We are taking an exceedingly great risk, a risk that will be more than death, but an eternal death and a condemnation. If we can help you tonight to become a child of God, to put Him on in baptism, to redeem your souls from death, or to return to Him from a lost state, we can help you. Whatever you need, I pray that you would come. Let us together we stand and sing.